Kia ora, everyone, and welcome to Good Fellow Podcasts. This episode is kindly supported by the Royal New Zealand College of General Practitioners, the Auckland faculty. I'm Dr. Louise Kugler, and today I welcome to the podcast Guyan Espiner to discuss alcohol use in New Zealand and choosing abstinence. Guyan is a journalist in print, television, and radio for nearly 30 years, including 14 years covering politics from the Press Gallery in Wellington. He has produced three major podcasts and more recently two TV documentaries focusing on alcohol and drug policy called Proof and Wasted, both of which screen on TVNZ. He currently works as a presenter and investigative journalist for RNZ and is the author of a new book, The Drinking Game. Kia ora, Guyan, and welcome to the podcast.
Kia ora, thanks for having me.
Well, it's wonderful to have you here, and thank you for discussing your journey with alcohol. I'm interested in what you've learned along the way. So you described yourself as a heavy yet controlled drinker, and this has been the way since your teens, abstaining from alcohol three nights a week, but making up for it on the other four. One morning you woke up after a big night and decided that you'd had enough and quit alcohol. This was over 4 years ago. So I'm interested in the events leading up to your decision to stop drinking. I wonder if you can tell us about this.
Yeah, well, the events leading up to it, I suppose, would span over that 30, 35 years. There was nothing particularly special about the end point. In the words of the Eliot poem, it died with a whimper rather than a bang. So I think we get used to this idea that there's always this sort of nadir or, you know, bottom point that the hero eventually pulls themselves out of, which is sort of gifted to us from popular culture. But no, that was nothing remarkable about that night at all. In fact, that's the point, really, that had been typical of many, many hundreds of nights over my drinking career, if you want to put it that way. And, you know, nothing was smashed or broken or nothing horrendous was done. It was just another night where I'd consumed far too much alcohol and couldn't remember exactly what had happened. In fact, large parts of the night were missing. And I woke up that morning and thought, gee, how many times do I have to do this to myself? I finally made the call after hundreds, probably, if not dozens, of failed mitigation attempts to finally think, well, this is a drug I cannot manage. I cannot manage it in a way that avoids shame, that avoids disappointing myself, that affects my health and is not who I want to be. My only shame is that it took me so long to actually realize and act on that. But yeah, there was no big tipping point in that respect. It was just the culmination of many, many, many attempts to mitigate, which failed.
So, Guyan, we use an acronym in health, the four L's. So we talk about the liver or health, lover and relationships, law and livelihood. So had alcohol infiltrated and affected any of those areas in your life specifically?
It had affected my own integrity of self, I suppose is the way to put it, and was doubtlessly affecting my health. I mean, I think I really realized that after I stopped drinking, how much my health improved. My sleep improved immediately. I used to struggle and always wake up at night. My mental health improved. This anxiety effect of the chemical influence of alcohol and leading an increasing anxiety as a depressant, and the shame and worry that you had done things that had let yourself down was definitely weighing heavily on my mind. And I think the lightness of being is one of the greatest joys of not drinking alcohol. So it undoubtedly affected my health. I'm a big runner. I found it difficult to keep my weight down drinking alcohol because it affected what I ate as well. It has a lot of insidious effects in that respect. I mean, you eat differently while you're drinking and you eat differently after you've been drinking. And so I found my diet, my mental health, my sleep, and my immune system was the surprising one to me. And I didn't know this. And there's a whole other conversation about the amount of information that we are given as consumers of alcohol about the health impacts of it. I didn't realize that the extent to which alcohol affects the immune system. And I found myself getting sick far less. I found myself not getting the amount of colds and flus and other impacts that I had on my health after I'd given up alcohol. I'm also a type 1 diabetic, which made excessive and heavy drinking of alcohol quite dangerous, actually. And I still drank for a year after I had that diagnosis, but I find it immeasurably easier to control my blood sugar without alcohol. You try drinking craft beer and controlling your blood sugars is not very easy. A lot of these products have high amounts of sugar in them, hence the weight gain. But as a diabetic, it's pretty difficult if you're drinking, especially the craft beers have a lot of sugar in them. But also the very real danger of not recognizing the signs of hypoglycemia, in other words, dropping below 4 millimole in your blood sugars, pretty significant and pretty dangerous. I think that would be the major one of those things that you've touched upon would be my health and mental health, both of which have improved quite considerably having gone alcohol-free.
That's fantastic. So tell us, while you were drinking, you came in contact with medical providers either through your diabetes or perhaps with your drinking. I'm just wondering, were you questioned about your drinking and what sort of advice were you given?
It's a really good question. I had that hidden shame about it in that, and I think a lot of heavy drinkers will tell you this, they hate talking about how much they drink. They hate being reminded about it. And this is the wonderful thing for a heavy drinker who wants to continue to be a heavy drinker. And in my view, that's up to them. I never make moral judgments about other people. But it's a drinker's paradise in New Zealand because no one ever calls you out on it. I was never asked why I was drinking so much, ever, in 35 years. And I say in the book, The Drinking Game, immediately when I stopped drinking, people would say, why aren't you drinking? And I found that this reverse burden of proof, extraordinary, permeates New Zealand culture. So you can have a massive night out in New Zealand and do some pretty embarrassing things. You could throw up in a cab or fall asleep in front of your boss. And maybe it's a little different nowadays, but mostly you're never going to be asked. And the next day, you can sort of shuffle and sidle your way through the day, and then everyone forgets about it and away you go again. And we all see this in our social groups, even flash end of town people. You know, there's always a couple in every group of 10 who are slurring their words at 9:30. No one really says anything. And most often their partners don't even say anything. But you asked about medical health professionals. Initially, they might ask about units, but most people don't know. And it was pretty difficult for people, even educated people who pay attention to these things. It's pretty easy for them to not give an honest answer. I would say I probably lied initially. I would usually say that I would drink about 14 units or something because I knew that was the limit. Yeah. I can't remember what exactly the number was at the time. They'd have changed it a little bit. I know in Britain they did. But anyway, there's a limit of units, and I would probably say that I was up around the max when it might have been two or three times that. I do remember one particular conversation with a GP, and I did ask him about it. Probably was, you know, in my early to mid-40s, so I still had a few heavy drinking years ahead of me. I'm 52 now. And I said to him, yeah, what about these beers that I'm drinking on Friday, Saturday nights? And so, and he said to me, well, you know, I think you should probably keep drinking them because, it's interesting, isn't it? Because the joy that you get out of it, the stress release that you get out of it, it's probably not much of a problem. It really stuck with me. I tell you what, if you're a drinker who wants to continue drinking and someone gives you an excuse to keep doing that, you're like, oh, sweet. My doctor told me I could keep drinking. Yeah. So I won't name him for obvious reasons, and he's not my doctor anymore. And I don't blame him. I get what he was saying. And maybe I think he, in my own non-medical expert opinion, I think he's got a point in that if you have controlled good drinking, it can be part of a healthy, enjoyable life. And I don't deny that right to anyone. And I'll give him this out. If he knew actually how much I was drinking, maybe he would have given me different advice. My point being is that you leap on stuff, which is why I did call out in the book, and I do call out when I see it, because the alcohol industry loves doing this. You know, we looked at this thing, you know, oh, red wine, oh, it's actually quite good for you. It's got resveratrol in it, even though you'd need to drink gallons of this stuff to get an actual proper dose. So we leap on these things, don't we? You know, actually, alcohol's good for you. Running isn't good for you because, it, you know, so, oh, gee, that means I don't have to do it. And so we do leap on this stuff, which is why I think we need to be really careful about what exactly the facts are. But no, in general, I've found that people don't, and doctors and GPs don't ask much about alcohol. It's still a taboo in New Zealand, I think, you know, that we find it difficult to ask and talk about. The other thing on a medical perspective that I noticed massively is my blood pressure dropped to a really, really good, safe level. It's bang on now, and it was really high with alcohol. And again, I did not know that relationship, did not know it until the doctor said, well, gee, you've got your blood pressure's back to like where it would be as a teenager. And I'd given up alcohol completely. And I looked it up and looked at some research papers, and the relationship between blood pressure and heavy drinking is quite considerable. So that's another thing that I didn't know. But I do think that probably doctors and medical professionals should be discussing this a bit more with people, you know, and giving them information and what some of the risks are, and that it's an option to be alcohol free.
So following up on that, Guyon, if you'd been given some different advice earlier, do you think you would have stopped drinking earlier?
Probably not, to be brutally honest. But I'm not, I mean, you know, everyone's different, aren't they? For me, the question, and that's why I pursued it in this book, is it's a big, massive cultural ocean liner, you know, that's dragging you all along. I mean, and if you're the GP, you're throwing a twig in a torrent at that point, aren't you, saying, hey, maybe you shouldn't drink. And then you walk outside and there's 15 billboards with Matthew McConaughey telling you that it's adventurous, sexually attractive and successful to drink alcohol, and all your mates are doing it, and the whole society is based on it, and every occasion from births, deaths, marriages, finding work, losing work is all based around alcohol. Then, as I say, you're throwing a twig in a torrent by telling people maybe you shouldn't be doing as much of this. So that's not to say we shouldn't have those conversations, and I don't want to contradict myself. We should be, but to me, the cultural drivers are where we need to do a lot of the work, you know, because I think those kinds of conversations fall on far more receptive ears, and they will already, you know, just having bars that are selling a greater diversity of drinks, having people coming in from different countries who don't have the same attitudes towards alcohol as a lot of New Zealanders do, a lot of those things and conversations and cultural change will make those kind of conversations more receptive, I think. It's just people don't have to think, oh my God, I'm going to give away my entire social life by doing it. I mean, it still happens to me. I was just asked yesterday, in a text, someone said, do you want to go out for a drink? That they put the words drink in quote marks, as though my choice of drink was going to be somehow invalid, or it's like, you know, I know you're a loser and can't drink alcohol, but hey, do you want to catch up? It's like, who cares what I'm drinking? Do I go, let's catch up for a coffee? Oh, no, you don't drink coffee. Oh, God, what are we going to do? You only drink tea. I mean, who cares? And so I think we still got a lot of work to do, but it's those cultural expectations and the really deep-rooted role that alcohol plays in our lives that makes those conversations with the GP really difficult, because if you're in a culture where alcohol is everything, you might as well be asking someone, oh, do you want to, can you stop walking outside, or do you want to stop meeting people, or, you know, if you're trying to tell them that they should be thinking about not doing something that's so integral to being a functioning person in society, then that's a bloody hard conversation without cultural change.
So picking up on that, what challenges have you faced since being alcohol-free, and how easy have you found it to socialise and live in New Zealand being alcohol-free?
I face big, big challenges. You know, let's be honest. When you first do it, it's very confronting. I couldn't believe the brutality and unvarnished scrutiny that I got moving from being someone who drank a lot to not drinking at all. I was asked at a school kids' sports lunchtime meeting, don't you drink? Because I didn't want a beer. And, you know, I'd go into a birthday party and put Diet Coke cans down on a table, and someone would say, oh, are you training for something? Why aren't you drinking? And then everyone would stop in the circle and look at you. And I was like, wow, you're going to apply your scrutiny to what I'm drinking tonight? Isn't that weird? And really uncomfortable and hard. I picked some pretty four events to go to initially, but this is just my life. I was going to a media awards event, journalists are big drinkers. It was incredibly tough. And I went to an event celebrating the artwork of Garage Project, who do very cool artwork for their beer cans. It's cool. Went along to that and got laughed at for ordering water, literally laughed at, which is pretty confronting and pretty tough. You know, this is 2022 or 2021. You know, this isn't 1954. It's amazing where we're still at with this. And, you know, you develop a better skin, a thicker skin, and you work out a strategy for people who are listening to this who are in that sort of situation. You've got to work out a strategy. And when you come into the party is crucial, the 5, 10, 15 minutes, because the host is really going to want you to drink. They really want you to drink because it reflects on their behavior as well. It's a strange projection what they're doing. If you go into a group and you're not drinking alcohol, they take that as a number of ways. You're a spy, you're letting people down, you're not bonding, you're commenting on their drinking, you're making a moral judgment, oh my God, what have I had to stop drinking? There's all those things are going on. So you've got to kind of navigate that and come up with some good strategies about what you're going to do. What is your choice of drink going to be? Some people go for the zero alcohol beers or something like that. I don't do that. We can talk about why if you want. You know, you need a strategy. You need a story about what you're doing and why you're doing it and how you're going to cope with those questions. You need to think that stuff out because it's going to happen and it's going to hit you. So you're going to need to know what to say because people are always very, very interested in what you're going to drink.
Let's pick up on that. So why the no zero alcohol option for you?
I don't want to put my foot on that first rung of the ladder because I know that knowing myself, once I get onto the first rung of the ladder is the next step, the low alcohol beers, and then I climb up the ladder to the top shelf as I did last time, is one reason. I'm also a bit of a bloody-minded person, and this is the journalist in me, and I am a bit skeptical of the big alcohol companies and the what's known as alibi marketing, where you say, you know, don't drink X beer if you're going to drive, and they show you a bottle of this perfectly curated, dripping, wet bottle of beer. And to me, I just think, oh, it looks like a nice beer, you know, the kind of 5% beer that I used to drink of their product. But I question the degree to which this is public-minded altruism or community-minded behavior and wonder the degree to which they're really just spruiking their product and while having it both ways. You see a lot of this stuff in the media, and sometimes we're a bit naive picking it up, I think, in my industry about saying, oh, there's been an explosion of sales of this low alcohol beer, and that the industry loves to push it. But really, I mean, they are pushing and making most of their money from people who drink way too much and damage their health. And if they can do a bit of greenwashing along the way and say, oh, but I'm selling all this zero alcohol beer and making themselves feel better, then so be it. I accept that that is a relatively skeptical or cynical view, and I do celebrate the fact that people, even drinkers, I think it's better for drinkers actually to have these products, because if you have a couple and a half, you know, strength beers in your night, you're going to be in a lot better shape when you get home and the next day and for your liver. So all of that's good as an option. I'm skeptical about their motivation. I don't want to give my money to the alcohol companies, frankly, either. And also, why would I want a fake product of something that doesn't suit me? So that's just me. So I'm not smashing it for everyone. I think it's cool that they're available, and it's cool that it's acceptable to do it now too, right? Like, again, that's part of the cultural change. But for me, I avoid them like the plague. I don't want to buy a big brand of beer just because it looks like a beer. I don't need to do that. But if it works for you, then cool. Because it's good for some people, especially, you know, they're starting out not drinking to get a big beer that's a zero beer. Then you won't get the question probably at a party. So you've got to think about that too. It's that people do that, you know. They pour the Coke into a glass or they, you know, to avoid the scrutiny because, yeah, it's real.
Yeah. And I'm interested to hear if the number of social invitations changed when you went alcohol free. Did it have an impact on how often you got asked out for a drink?
I think it probably did, and people do possibly, some have dropped away, and it is an interesting social experiment, the degree to which those relationships are based on alcohol. And again, it's amazing really how deep this is. I mean, the extent to which we become dependent on it. And over time, I mean, if you've learned to do that from 15, which I did, right? I bonded with my mates at 14, 15. So all those relationships, all those friendships, all involved alcohol, you know, and it's quite hard to switch off that. So you've got to be, it's a challenge. It's exciting though. And it's raw and it's real for people. So I don't want to present it as a utterly negative thing. It is quite a scary thing at first. And you need to find ways to evolve with that. But it's raw and it's real and the emotions are yours. You know, they're not addled by a drug, which is quite interesting. It is challenging in that respect. And that's why I think a lot of people are frightened to give it up. They know that it's hurting them. They hate themselves for doing it, but they're so bloody scared. And I was, that it will irrevocably change and damage their social life, and they'll become sort of some sort of pariah, that they are too frightened to do it. Which is part of the reason I wrote that book, was that I want people to know it's okay and you can live a good life without it, and we should be able to talk and celebrate that and have it as a proper option for ordinary people. You know, this idea that it's a binary proposition. You're either a social drinker or you're a raging alcoholic and there's no in between. That it should just be a legitimate option. Either it's just a night or a week or a night that you're not drinking, or it's a lifelong decision. That should be a celebrated normal position. You don't see that in any of the public advertising. You see good-natured, well-intentioned, motivational advertising for basically saying, if you're going to get really pissed tonight, don't drive. Okay, that's great. But where's the public stuff about, you know, three guys going out and one of them's drinking Diet Coke, or one of them's, you know? It's that sort of stuff that people need to feel and know is okay, that everyone's not going to turn around, the whole bar is going to stop and look at you and single you out. That's the issue we've got, I reckon. It's just seen as that's part of the social fabric. You'll see TV reporters do it too. You know, they're down on the waterfront on a finish of a yacht race or at the end of a game, and it's said, oh, I guess you'll be having a big night tonight, or, you know, the champagne corks are popping here. And that might sound nitpicky or being, but it's just so woven into that's how you're going to celebrate. And if you don't do that, then somehow you're opting out of any joy. When did we come to think that joy was associated with drug use and wasn't possible without it? That's our failure to acknowledge that this is a drug that's at the heart of this problem for me, the cultural problem. I haven't got anything against drug use, which might sound a controversial thing to say, but humans have been using drugs for hundreds and thousands of years. But we don't acknowledge that it's a drug. We somehow think it's just, I don't know, something that you can do from about the age of 14. It's like water or part of the air we breathe. And once you've got that attitude, disassociating yourself from it is bloody hard to do.
So picking up on that, so you've mentioned alcohol being a drug, but actually we know it's a type 1 carcinogen, which has been classified by the World Health Organization. And as you say, it's infiltrated New Zealand in a really unhealthy way. So what do you think New Zealand needs to do differently with respect to alcohol to change that culture and to make it less acceptable?
It's about availability, price, and marketing. I mean, they are the three big things that they will tell you. I mean, and this isn't just some reckon. This is the evidence produced by numerous studies that have reproduced all around the world. And New Zealand fails miserably on all of those things. We saturate especially poor communities with alcohol outlets. What do you think is going to happen if you put a whole bunch of shop selling a particular product? We do this with lotto, we do this with fast food, and we do it with alcohol. We know they're the best customers. We saturate these communities. You're forcing them to run the gauntlet every bloody day of being in stressful situations and walking past alcohol outlets trying to grab you in. I know even from my background, which is a pretty privileged one, I grew up as a son of a doctor in a good home in Christchurch, I would rush to alcohol to cope with stress. How do you think you're going to go if you're dealing with high levels of stress every day? You're really forcing those communities into a really difficult position. Your massive oversupply, then you've got all the basic rules of economics. Then you're selling it at prices which are really low. And okay, we've had the cost of living crisis, we've had inflation for a small amount of time, but any of these studies will show you, if you track the price, that alcohol has become more affordable over time. and that at some points is sold for around 68 cents a standard drink if you buy a cask of wine. Now, that may have shifted a little bit in this unusual time of high inflation. But in short, alcohol prices have been rising slower than wages, and so alcohol has become more affordable. So you, all the basic rules of economics, you're massively oversupplying it, you're selling it at low prices. And then it's the cultural strand that we've been talking about in terms of the marketing and sponsorship, which is insidious and, again, just draws you into that world where it is just part of the fabric, and that your sport and your success. And so everywhere you look, you are seeing this association with alcohol. And then you wonder why we have a massive problem with it. So you ask what we could do. Well, we could look at changing all those things. And we try to, and then you get to the lobbying and the why not, and we can talk about that too if you like. Again, anyone you ask, any expert group you set up tells you it's time to cut the link between sponsorship of sport and alcohol, yet we don't do it. We say to communities, oh, well, maybe you could set your own rules about when you get it, because if you're allowed to buy alcohol till 11 o'clock at night, do you think those decisions made when you walk into the bottle store at 10:58 p.m. are as good as the decisions you made at 7:30? They're not. I can tell you that from firsthand experience. The problem with this particular drug is that it affects your decision making and the quality of your decision making and the executive functions of the brain. So that decision to buy a bottle of wine for the two of you made at 7:30 is a very different decision that is made at 10:30 at night. And so some of these basic things, like controlling the availability and the time of alcohol, are obviously going to have an impact. And yet when we try and do any of these things, the industry and their hired guns push back on it. The politicians are too frightened to act because it's a third rail issue for them. And they freak out about getting between New Zealanders and their booze. And they don't do anything. And unfortunately, this has been a bit of a revolving door of ideas and pushback for the last couple of decades now, at least since the big Palmer report. When was that? 2010, that Sir Geoffrey Palmer did. Alcohol and Curbing the Harm report for the Law Commission, I think, was 2009. So we've been really having those discussions since then and haven't really made much progress.
What about national health guidelines? Do you have any opinions about those? I was quite excited this week to learn that Canada had decreased its recommendations for healthy drinking. Do you think things like that make a difference? So they've dropped down to 2 standard drinks, full stop, per week before you start to see harm. What do you think about us tightening up our guidance?
I think it probably would be quite good, depending on how it was done and how the message was conveyed. What I was amazed at is that the lack of knowledge, and I include myself in this, about some quite disturbing things relating to alcohol and health. I think it's about 10% of people, it might have been 9 or 10% of people, knew about the link between breast cancer and bowel cancer and alcohol, or any cancer. I think about 7 cancers that are directly linked to alcohol. Very few people know that. They know it's going to affect your liver. They've known that for a long time. If you talk to ordinary people, they say, oh yeah, it's going to affect my liver. And they think about a beer belly. They don't think about the sugar inherent in alcohol, which is quite considerable. So even if you're drinking shots of vodka, for example, not that I'm recommending that, but that would lead to weight gain. So the knowledge is simply not there and would make a significant impact, I think. I think we could and should do more on this space. I just don't really see it anywhere, eh? I mean, and when you try and put the labels on the bottles, I mean, they push back massively on that. It was a 20-year fight to get fetal alcohol information on alcohol vessels. There's no warnings for cancer. You can sell that product with no warnings on that. The tobacco industry didn't get away with that forever. So I think we could do a lot more to tell people about the harms of alcohol. And I think that the legacy and tail of that, tail, T-A-I-L, and tail, T-A-L-E, about that somehow being good for you, like a small amount of alcohol actually being good for you, which has now really been proven as bollocks, really. It looked good, didn't it? And it sort of felt right that you could drink a glass of red wine and it would somehow unclog your arteries or something. But it didn't turn out really to be true. But that's the sort of thing you're battling. So yeah, I think good, proper, factual information told well and, you know, in the right way could be really useful, yeah, and valuable.
And what about as a parent, Guyon? So what would you do, or what are you planning to do with your young person when it comes to discussing alcohol and safe drinking within New Zealand?
Interesting question, and I've been grappling with that already. I've got a 9-year-old daughter, and she knows about my journey. She's got my book. She hasn't read it. But we've been having these conversations for a couple of years. I take a pretty 100% truth thing, which might be a bit controversial for some parents. I tell her about drugs. I tell her about that humans have used drugs. I tell her that adults like to have treats where that makes them feel fuzzy or funny, or this is something that humans have done. And this is a drug that some people can manage and have a couple of times a week as a nice treat, and it makes them feel nice and fuzzy and funny. But a lot of people can't manage it well, and I was one of them, and I drank too much, and if you drink too much of it, you're going to get into trouble and it hurts your health. It's actually not that hard. And so I'm not a let's abstinence person, you know, I'm not a prohibition person. Don't even call myself an advocate for being sober. I'm not that person. I'm just saying that for a lot of us, about 20 or 30% of us even, alcohol is not a drug that we can manage safely. It does catastrophic harm. And the idea that we would be promoting this really strongly. It's not just that we're making it available. It's not a prohibition argument. And that's not the binary proposition. It's not the prohibitionists versus the people who think we should live in a free society. I think all that too. I'm just saying, are you really comfortable with promoting the absolute hell out of this drug and allowing it to be deeply woven into every aspect of our lives when we know the carnage that it causes? To come back to your question, I think we've got to just be honest with our kids and young people about that. And I think acknowledging that it's a drug that sits along a lot of other intoxicants that society has used and does use, and how we can manage that is the actual real adult conversation. Otherwise, you're back to a sort of, was it Reagan era, just say no sort of thing, which isn't realistic. The societies have always used intoxicants to take the cortex offline at times. How do we do that safely in a way that reduces harm is the conversation, I think, realistically, that we need to have. That's my view. And it, as I say, it may be controversial to some. But I think this idea that separating alcohol out from those other conversations is part of the problem that we have. So we talk about alcohol and other drugs. And I think that gives alcohol a free pass, as though somehow it's not, when it's quite scientifically proven as the most dangerous drug we have. So isn't that a weird situation that we've got ourselves into, that we don't classify it and think about it as a drug, and yet it's a brutally dangerous one? If I took a drug and was throwing up all the next day, made an idiot of myself and written off my entire weekend and was throwing up in a hotel room, you'd be horrified. Oh my God, what are you doing? You know, you've taken this test. It's just a blink of an eyelid for alcohol. How do we get ourselves into that position? That's the one that we need to reverse out of and do a 3-pointer and head off in the other direction. And those are the kinds of questions and things that we need to talk about with our kids. I've been out with my daughter before, and, you know, we were going for a meal in town and stuff, and then I saw this young woman. It must have been about 9 o'clock or 8:30. It was still light in summer, possibly. And she was staggering, you know, nicely dressed woman, and obviously, you know, cared about herself and her appearance and things, and been out to dinner, and she was staggering down the street. And my daughter was horrified, you know, and I just had an honest conversation with her about, well, look, you know, that's what happens if you drink, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 glasses of wine, you know, that's going to happen to you. Not to scare her, just having honest conversations about it. And I think we tend to shy away from that and think, oh, they're not ready for this conversation. Oh, she might have, you know, make up some sort of story or something, or tell kids that, or not even talk about alcohol and just say, stay away from drugs or something. This is silly. Just be honest and realistic about it. And don't give alcohol a special status as not a drug, but a food, or however you want to class it. They've been getting a free pass for too long, and it's doing us damage.
Really good points. Yeah, no, I totally agree with you, having those very open and honest conversations. In your research, introducing young people to alcohol, is there a safe way to do it? We know it's a drug, we know it's a carcinogen, but if they are going to drink, how can we do this safely? Have you had any insight into that?
I have, and I don't know. I really don't. My parents did everything right, as they thought at the time. They took the European approach that you should introduce your children to sipping wine. I don't think they quite watered down wine, as I think the French and Italians possibly do, but certainly introduced that idea of having alcohol around and having it in small amounts. And it worked my brothers. This is the difficult thing, right? I mean, I got two brothers who never had a problem with alcohol. I don't think I've seen either of them drunk. And me, who got myself into all sorts of strife. So it is difficult. I think, I reckon this is the main message for me, is that this is a drug that for a good whack of people, 20 or 30%, maybe a million New Zealanders, they can't use it safely. And don't feel left out as an outsider or there's something wrong with you if you're one of those people. This is a lot of us. That's the message I never got. That's part of the problem, right? Because if you're saying, it's like that thing about totalitarian states, that everything's banned except the stuff which is compulsory. So we've banned every other drug, right? But we've got this one drug that you're allowed to have, and it's almost compulsory in New Zealand, as we've talked about, because it's every occasion and you're a weirdo if you don't do it. What we need to do, in my view, and it's just my view, so look, you know, take it for what it is, we need to inculcate and push the message out that this is a drug that for a lot of people, they can use it safely in small amounts as a treat, and they can enjoy it. But there's a lot of us who can't, and don't feel bad if you're one of those people. I mean, imagine if you had a product, you put your product out, and this 20% of people who can't use it safely, you'd be laughed out of town if you tried to put it on the market. It's a massive whack of people. So I think people should just realize that, oh, yeah, nah, oh, do you drink? Nah, I won't have alcohol because it doesn't suit me. That should be a normal thing to say, right? If we could get there, a lot of this other stuff would go away. Because people would get, you know, maybe teenagers, maybe they wouldn't, but maybe younger people would have a couple of bad nights out and throw up and or feel unhappy about the way they're drinking. And they would say, I don't drink because it doesn't suit me. And that could be a normal thing to say. I tell you what, at high school, you were an utter pariah. I did not know one person who did not drink, who could not have survived socially, you know. Maybe there were, and that was why I didn't know them. But it was just impossible to survive socially without alcohol. I don't think it's quite the same, and I think we're probably making progress. But wouldn't that be good if we, you know, like some people say, oh, I'm lactose intolerant, or I'm, you know, whatever it is. Just be like that. Oh, no, it doesn't suit me. I mean, there are many cultures that are like that. We should be able to just say, I won't have a beer. No, alcohol doesn't really suit me. I have this. And that should be a normal position to take, because it's true too, right? At least 20 or 30% of us, I mean, 20% if you take the hazardous drinkers, it should be considered a pretty normal position that, yeah, no, it doesn't suit me.
Yeah, good points there. So just winding up our time now today, I'm just thinking about your thoughts as to what we as health professionals can do to get involved in changing New Zealand's drinking culture. What would your thoughts be there?
I've never been asked or considered that question, and I don't know how or how to respond to that. Do you believe what you're doing now is working? You know, you're a lot better qualified to answer it than me. The one thing I would say is I think we need to celebrate the joy of an alcohol-free life better and be less heavy about this in terms of the cultural change. So moving from a, you shouldn't be doing this, you know, to, hey, look at all the fun that I'm having. And not having any alcohol in that situation. Like, so shifting the lens or shifting the trajectory of this, right? You know, where are the public health campaigns that are just subtle and cool about a dude who, you know, is in a bar and is obviously having a Diet Coke? I'm not spruiking Coca-Cola, but I'm a diabetic, so I have to find drinks that are sugar-free as well as alcohol-free. Like, celebrating the fact that of people having cool lives without alcohol, which is why I love people like Paddy Gower, who's such a big iconic New Zealander really now, you know, and quite a tough, iconic dude doing that, you know, because it's all, don't do this, don't drink and drive, you better watch it, you're going to have so many units, we've got to figure out how Kiwis work and the psychology of this and train some of the bloody lobbyists and get them over to the other side. I don't know. I just celebrate the fact that you can have a great life with a lot of joy without alcohol, and try and shift the burden there. I'm not saying that that's the whole thing. All your stuff that you're doing is great, and I don't have expertise on that. I just think, as someone who's looks at messaging and media and has examined quite a lot of that stuff, I'm not seeing a celebration of the fact that you can live a great life without alcohol. And I'd like to see that. It's made my life easier.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for your time today. It's been enlightening and an absolute pleasure talking to you. I've really enjoyed it.
Thanks, Louise. Really appreciated the opportunity to talk about it.
Thank you. If you're a New Zealand GP, please claim your CPD points for listening to this podcast. You'll find a list of resources on our website, goodfellowunit.org. Thank you for listening.